Ladies and gentlemen, we'll bring this property tax relief and local sales tax division to order. And I would like to welcome everyone back. I was noticing in our minutes that March 28th was the last time we met here. And what, that 10 and a half months ago already? It seems like it was almost just yesterday. So welcome back to everyone. I would also like to introduce our pages. We have, well, wait till she, I'll introduce Josh first. Josh Nye, you'd wave your hands for everyone to see. And we also have an intern, Lisa Pullman, if you would raise your hand. And Karen Baker is not a new page. And Margaret Van Heel is our other page who is working the phone there. So thank you so much and welcome, members. And we don't have enough to approve the minutes, but you all should have in your packets a little summary of the property tax hearings that we had last week. We had three on February 6th and three on February 7th. And, you know, I think what we found out there is that certainly the rising property taxes, that is a problem that is not going away and, in fact, escalating. And, you know, I want to thank all the members who could make that and all the non-division members who could make it and all the residents around the state that attended. We had roughly from about a low of 25 at a meeting to about 80, I think, in St. Cloud. So they were well attended. We had over 85 testifiers that gave input. And I think what we saw, and I summarize this here, is kind of some of the general things that we heard is that what we do as a state does impact property taxes. Another area we heard over and over from the counties again, dealing with targeted case management and child protection. And the lack of funding from the federal government, in many respects, is creating some huge holes in budgets that are going to have to be made up through property taxes. School debt equalization was another big issue, both on the operating referendum and debt service, on how that really has escalated property taxes. What we heard time and time again is the state funding, or kind of the flat funding for transportation and education leads to local units of government having to raise their property taxes too. And then local government aid, county program aid are vital to those cities and counties who qualify for that and who need that. So those are some things, and I think it's a good way to start the year off from that. You should have all behind the cover letter. Paul has put together some unofficial, informal notes of the meeting. We have official minutes of those meetings because they were official hearings. But Paul has also put together a more detailed summary of what happened there, so if you could take a look at that. But again, thanks for all those who did attend, and staff did just a wonderful, wonderful job of getting that organized and, you know, getting the places set up and so forth. So with that, I think we'll move to the agenda, and the first thing we're going to deal with is the Office of the Legislative Auditor report on Green Acres, and we have Jody Hauer who will be presenting that, and Mr. James Noble, the Legislative Auditor, is here, I think, somewhere. Was he? I know he walked in, but he had to, I know he had a meeting, but before you begin, I have to say that when you look at the job the Office of the Legislative Auditor does, is really stellar. I mean, this is, when you go through here, I mean, it's not just Green Acres, but I got to see what percent of land in the counties are agriculture. I mean, just there's so much great information and such great detail, and it represents the work you do on all of your reports. So I first of all want to thank the office for excellent work throughout, but also on this Green Acres.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Ms. Hauer, if you want to take us through this is an issue that a lot of people are working on, and I think you've brought up here a lot of the concerns that we need to work on, but we'll listen to your report, and then, you know, if you have members, if you have questions during the report that, you know, can't wait towards the end, feel free to ask Ms. Hauer for that question. So, Ms. Hauer, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members. My name is Jody Hauer. For the record, I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm going to start by giving just a quick overview of the findings from our evaluation of the Green Acres Program and the Farmland Preservation Program, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on each of them. But just in general, the Green Acres Program, from the research we did, we concluded that the program does effectively reduce property taxes for certain farmland owners, but it doesn't help all who might be eligible. We think it's unclear whether the program's goals include benefiting certain landowners and certain types of land that right now are eligible. For instance, beneficiaries can include people who are not farming. The program has some eligibility criteria that we think are not workable. Plus, the Green Acres Program has not been implemented consistently around the state from county to county.
Ms. Hauer, sorry, but if I can interrupt all members, you do have a sheet that if you can also follow along this way if you want. Please proceed.
Thank you. And then regarding the preservation of farmland, our main finding was that the two programs Minnesota has for farmland preservation can help shape development or stage the pace of development, but the programs are not adequate to preserve farmland for the long term. And I'll come back to that in a moment, but I'm going to start with more detail on the Green Acres Program. The Green Acres Program applies only to farmland where the land's value has increased due to non-agricultural factors, things like development pressures that drive up the price of the land. And to be eligible, the landowner has to meet certain requirements. First, there are ownership requirements, and I'm not going to go into detail on those now, but if there are questions about it, let me know. There's a requirement that the land produce a certain amount of income each year. And the land has to be classified as agricultural. It has to be at least 10 acres in size or be a nursery or a greenhouse, and it has to be primarily devoted to agricultural use. Those are all statutory requirements. And overall, we found that the Green Acres Program does effectively equalize property taxes for the landowners that are in the program. It does this because it significantly reduces the value of the land that's enrolled. Now, Green Acres land is valued according to its agricultural use, not according to the highest and best use that assessors typically use when they set the values for land. And the difference between those two can be quite large. Let me give you an example. In 2007, we had the average value for an acre of farmland in the four very fast-growing counties just immediately north of the metropolitan area. That average was $6,500 an acre, for the average estimated market value. And by contrast, the Green Acres value for that 1 acre was on the average $1,900. So that's about a threefold difference between the estimated market value and the low agricultural use value for that 1 acre. Now, due to those lower taxable values, the owners of that land pay lower property taxes. And we estimated that last year, 2007, the program reduced participants' property taxes by about $35 million around the state. Beyond those tax benefits, the special assessments that are typically charged for public improvements, sewer, water, those kinds of improvements, those are deferred typically until the owners sell their land. And when the land is sold, the owners are required to pay back 3 years worth of the tax breaks that they received, but any years of tax deductions that occurred prior to that time can be considered permanent tax breaks. Now, even though we found the program effective
Representative,
overall,
excuse me, Representative Anderson, do you have a question?
I apologize for interrupting, Mr. Chair. Does that include school referendums and things like that, the deferment?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's for, are you talking about the special assessments or are you talking about the...
So the
overall tax rate remains the same. It's just that the amount of value that's subject to the tax is so much lower for those that are enrolled in the program.
Okay.
Thank you.
So even though we found that the program is effective at equalization, we think that it has some limits, and I'll talk about those now. First of all, the program is not available statewide. There are 35 counties that do not have land enrolled in the program, even though some of the county assessors in those counties reported to us that non-agricultural factors have influenced the price of the land in those, in at least parts of those counties. Now this map shows what percentage of farmland in each county is enrolled in the Green Acres program. The counties in white are the ones that do not have land enrolled. The one exception I have to point out, Hennepin County does have Green Acres land. It's in white here just because data are not available on the number of farmland acres on a per county basis. But the darkest green in the map represents those areas that have the greatest concentration of Green Acres land enrolled. Now, second, we think that the program's effectiveness on equalization is limited because some landowners simply decide against applying. They're not interested. They might mistrust government programs. They simply don't want to get involved. They might be on the verge of selling their land soon, so they're not going to apply. And then third, we think that not all landowners may be aware of the program. We did interview county assessors in 48 of the counties that have land enrolled in the program, and we found 5 counties that have relatively low enrollment, and they only provide information when requested by the landowner. By contrast, most other counties will send mailings or other kinds of information out to potentially eligible landowners. Now, besides tax equalization, we looked at the program's effect on preserving farmland. And this is somewhat of a question because the law does not specifically state that farmland preservation is one of the goals of the program. But a lot of people you'll talk to, assessors and others, landowners and others, do believe that farmland preservation is one of the goals of the program. So we looked at how well the program works in that arena. And we concluded that the program does not effectively preserve farmland for a couple of reasons. First, the program does not require any kind of a long-term commitment to the land by the owner. It's not restricted to regions that have been zoned for long-term agricultural use. Owners can divide, sell their land at any point. And the amount of the tax benefit, while it can be significant, is small when you compare it to the rapid rise in farmland values over time. Let me give you an example. An average 80-acre farm, again in that 4-county fast-growing area just north of the metropolitan area, we found that back in 1993, that 80-acre farm was valued at about $62,000. But it increased from that to last year when it was over $520,000 for that 80 acres. Now, the average tax benefit for that land that was in the program was at $1,350 last year, and it would have been somewhat lower of a tax break in the preceding years. And then finally, the program's effect on preserving farmland is what we would call tenuous because it's not targeted to high-quality land. Could be poor-quality soils, could be prime-quality soils, but it's not targeted in any way, nor is it targeted to land that's at risk of soon being developed. But there are also controversies over who and what types of land receive the Green Acres benefit. And we concluded that it's unclear whether the goals in the law include benefiting certain landowners, certain types of land that right now are eligible. Let me give you some examples. People who are not farmers can qualify for the Green Acres program. Landowners can benefit even when most of their land is not in agricultural production. As an example here, land that might be set aside in the conservation program is eligible by law for the program. And so could parcels that are mostly wooded, for instance, but they still have 10 acres of tillable land, and even if they have 70 acres of wooded, they still would also be eligible for the program. Land that has values that have increased due to recreational purposes, like hunting, also qualifies. And another source of controversy is small farms, the 10 or 12 or 15 acre farms. In some cases, it's difficult to determine whether those smaller farms are simply larger residential properties or whether they truly are primarily devoted to agricultural use. Now, I do want to emphasize that all of these types of cases are legal now under Minnesota law. They do all qualify. But we think it's important for the legislature to review who should be eligible because, first of all, the tax benefits to the individual landowner are sizable. They can be very great. And then secondly, the tax relief that is provided through this program is largely paid for by shifting the tax burden onto others in the community who are not enrolled in the program. We also concluded there are some problems with the eligibility criteria that are in law. Now, I mentioned at the start that the program does impose a minimum income to come from the land in order to qualify for the program. Now, the income threshold has several problems. First of all, it was set back in 1969. It hasn't been aligned with land rents since that time. Secondly, assessors find that landowners simply don't like handing over financial information. You know, they balk at that because they feel that's private information. They don't like giving that to the assessor, and there are some problems there. Not all farmers file the particular income tax form that most assessors typically use to verify income that's reported on the application. And assessors don't have access to income tax information that is classified as private information, and so they really don't have a good means for verifying the data that's submitted on the application. Now, another separate problem has arisen over how assessors classify the land as agricultural. We have, obviously, Minnesota statutes on classification of land. Those statutes do define types of agricultural products. The grains or bees and apiary products are part of what the statutes say are agricultural, but the statutes don't specify how much is sufficient to qualify for agricultural. So there are questions about how many acres containing how many beehives would qualify for that agricultural classification. And there's a similar problem with the statutory language in the Green Acres Law because, as I said earlier, it requires the land to be primarily devoted to agricultural use, but the statutes do not define what is primarily devoted. So it can be interpreted differently, and we found that it is a subjective judgment from county to county. We also found that there have been areas where there are other areas where the implementation has been subjective and inconsistent from county to county around the state. First of all, counties are not uniform in whether they verify the income that's supplied on the application form. I've already mentioned there's some variation in how assessors define land as primarily agricultural. Counties varied in how they treat parcels that have multiple owners. In about half of the counties that do have Green Acres land, we found that county assessors have the ability for a particular parcel to classify part of it as residential and then the remaining part of that parcel as agricultural. But in some of those counties, the part that's classified as agricultural can become eligible for Green Acres, but elsewhere that's not allowed. And then finally, we saw variation in how county assessors inform landowners about the program. Now, many of the problems that I've talked about and that we document in the report, they were apparent before we conducted our evaluation. The Department of Revenue in October of 2007 issued a bulletin with the intent of helping achieve statewide implementation of the Green Acres program. In the bulletin, the department describes the difficulties that assessors have in setting that low agricultural use value for their Green Acres parcels around the state. The department believes that there are very few sales left in most parts of the state that are made purely for agricultural uses only, that are not influenced by the non-agricultural factors. Now, in the bulletin, the department does describe a method that it proposes to use to set that low agricultural use value in each county that has land enrolled. And we think that the method that they propose is reasonable in most respects. It will help set the values, we think, in a reasonable way for the tillable land. But we think it's less useful for the non-tillable land. And there are quite a few non-tillable acres in the Green Acres program. We estimated that about 38% of the acreage is non-tillable. So essentially, for those non-tillable acres, what the method will do is set a single statewide percentage that will apply in each county, so that the non-tillable land will be valued at half of the tillable value, regardless of the county. And we think that that's unrealistic because we know that in some counties, in particular some in north central Minnesota, the value of that non-tillable land is much closer to the value of the tillable land. And we think that there are different ways of getting at that non-tillable land value that we think the department can consider. Now, the bulletin also goes on to provide some guidance to assessors in an attempt to get some more consistency around the state. We think that guidance is good, it's valuable. We do point out a few additional subject areas where we think more guidance could also be helpful. Now, I'll summarize the recommendations that we think are necessary for the program. We think that the legislature should clarify in statute who and what type of land should benefit from the Green Acres program. We think the legislature should change the Green Acres Law by eliminating that criterion for a minimum income threshold, at the same time that it would add specificity to the statutes for classifying land as agricultural and for defining primarily agricultural in use. And we think the Department of Revenue should continue its efforts to get more consistency around the state in the implementation of the program, but we think it should make some changes, including to how it would value the non-tillable acres. Now, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move on to briefly talk about our findings on the Ag Land Preservation Program.
Very good.
And then I'll sum up. Minnesota has two separate programs for specifically designed for preserving agricultural land. One is for the seven counties in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and the second is designed for counties outside of the metropolitan area in greater Minnesota. The benefits of the two programs are similar, but there are some important differences. Land that's enrolled in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserve Program enjoys the lower tax value similar to the Green Acres Program, but that lower taxable value is not available for the Farmland Preservation Program in greater Minnesota. In both programs, the participants enjoy $1.50 per acre tax credit each year. The public improvements, like the water and sewer that we mentioned earlier, are not allowed within an agricultural preserve, and the owners typically don't pay any special assessments for those kinds of public improvements that might be built in their vicinity. Cities and towns are prohibited from passing ordinances that unreasonably restrict agricultural practices or farm structures, and cities are not allowed to annex agricultural preserve land in its township unless it meets certain very specific conditions. Now, we found that the farmland preservation programs can help to shape development and affect the pace of development, slow the pace. The program requires that restrictive covenants be placed on the title to the land enrolled in the program, and those restrictive covenants require that the owner use that land for agricultural purposes only. They are in place for a minimum of 8 years. That both can be extended, and many are, but the owners have at least a minimum of 8 years for which they have to abide by that restrictive covenant. Now, many of the local officials that we interviewed during our evaluation considered this program to be a help. They felt it really helped support their local agricultural land policies. They saw that it could help prevent the kinds of scattered developments that would have residences built nearby to farms and then have those new residents discover that they had land use conflicts because of the noise or smell or dust that arise naturally from the farming operations. But at the same time, we felt that the programs are not effective at preserving farmland over the long term for a couple of reasons. First, the economic forces that are out there, the market conditions that are out there, have made farmland around the state extremely valuable. So the benefits of the program, although they can be considerable in an instance, they are small when you compare them to the economic gain of actually selling that land. Let me give you an example. Estimated market values for an acre of farmland just over the last 10 years in the metropolitan area increased by an average of $8,100. And in greater Minnesota, the average increase was $1,400. When you have those kinds of high increases in the land values, they can outweigh the program's incentives to keep the land in agricultural production. Another factor that we think limits the effectiveness of the programs is the enrollment. Enrollment in the program is low, and it has been declining. And this table illustrates that. You can see that of the nine counties that participate in these two farmland preservation programs, only one county, and that's Carver, has more than half of its farmland acreage enrolled in the program. All nine of the counties have had decreases in enrollment since enrollment peaked back in the late 1990s. And as you can see, the loss of farmland has varied from county to county, but in most counties, it has been in double digits. Let me give you one example. Scott County, of course, in the metropolitan area, you can see as of last year, only 6% of its farmland acres were enrolled in the Metropolitan Agricultural Preserves Program, and 15% of its acres that had been enrolled are no longer enrolled as of the late 1990s. Another factor that limits the effectiveness of the programs is the low number of governments that participate in the Greater Minnesota program. Now, only three counties in Greater Minnesota have ever had land enrolled in the Greater Minnesota program. And of those three, it's Waseca, Winona, and Wright counties, none of them has more than a third of the farmland acres enrolled in the program. So just the fact that there's not that great of participation, and that among the counties that do participate, there isn't a large number of acres enrolled, that limits how effective the program can be in preserving farmland. And then finally, the program's effectiveness is limited because it's relatively easy for the participants to withdraw. They do have that 8-year limitation, but the covenant can terminate after 8 years, and at that point, the participants can withdraw from the program without a penalty. Now, beyond the questions on effectiveness, we looked at the, we found that there is no agency or person at either the state or the local level that has authority for enforcing the farmland preservation program. The law has no sanctions for noncompliance. And we did learn of a handful of cases, not a large number, a small number, but some where the land within an agricultural preserve had been developed before that 8-year period expired or before the owner filed for notice for expiring that, terminating that agricultural preserve. And the final thing I'll talk about is the revenues that are raised through the agricultural land preservation program. Participating counties have the authority to charge $5 whenever they register a deed or a mortgage in their county. And the county share of those revenues stay in the county and go into what's called a conservation account. Now, counties use that money to reimburse the $1.50 per acre tax credit that I mentioned earlier that goes to the owners that have land enrolled. Beyond that, if there's money left over after the tax credit is reimbursed, counties are authorized by law to use those remaining revenues for certain specified purposes. Now, specifically, the law says that the money can be used for farmland preservation and conservation planning and for preventing soil erosion. So we went and looked at how counties have been spending those dollars over the last 5 years. And what we saw is that most of that money is used to help the counties fund their water and soil conservation districts. And those districts use the money typically on soil conservation and on activities that help prevent soil erosion, which obviously are very well aligned with the intent of the law. We did see, though, a small number of projects that were, in our opinion, only very loosely tied to what's allowed in the law. One example is the Master Gardener program. By themselves, there weren't any programs, but someone could question whether or not they actually fall within the parameters of what the law allows for these excess revenues coming from the $5 fee. Now, those very few projects that we consider to be loosely tied to what's allowed in law were approved locally because the language within the law can be interpreted very broadly. So, as a result of our findings, we recommend that if Minnesota does wish to preserve farmland for the long term, then the legislature has to consider implementing some programs other than what now exists. And there are other strategies, but they're all expensive. I mean, there are land acquisition programs. There are programs that would purchase development rights, but all of them are quite costly. We do think the legislature should improve the existing programs by specifying in law who should enforce them and by setting some penalties when there is noncompliance. And finally, we think the legislature should determine whether spending those $5 fee revenues on projects other than farmland preservation or other than soil conservation is allowable. If it is unacceptable, then the legislature should specify in law what activities are unallowable, because right now that's not clear. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I've concluded my formal remarks. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Ms. Howard, thank you so much for that. And before we go any further, because I know we've got one member that has a bill up in another committee that's been very instrumental in this, Representative Demmer from the division and Representative Conan from the Tax Committee have been working with Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines on this issue, and I know working also with the Department of Revenue. And before Representative Demmer leaves, if you've got any comments or anything you'd care to...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Conan and I have met with Ms. Baker and Mr. Hines a few times. And quite frankly, we're spending a lot of our time trying to get our arms around this issue. And of course, one of the issues is waiting for the legislative auditor's report to come out, which was very helpful and kind of crystallized for us some of the things that we had thought about. And just to summarize, I guess, you know, the report and kind of what our thinking was and where we're at, there's some very fundamental things, Mr. Chair, we have to decide about with Green Acres. You know, do we, and just as some thoughts that I had, you know, how are we, do we want it to reduce the property taxes and why of ag land? I mean, I think we have to think about that fundamentally. What are we trying to accomplish? The fundamental issue is it the land use that we're trying to identify for change, or is it the land owner that we're trying to identify? And that gets into who owns the land, where their income comes from, how much income they make from where. Is that determinant? It should be. It is now, but it should be. Should it be? That's the question. A big issue is probably definitions, Mr. Chair and members. You know, how do we define a farmer anymore? How do we define tillable? Because farming practices have changed, and non-tillable farming is almost an oxymoron in compared to the previous definitions of tillable and non-tillable. You know, productive versus non-productive. What was used to be thought of as non-productive forest land or whatever is now sometimes valued higher than quote-unquote productive tillable farmland. So we have to look at productive versus non-productive. And quite frankly, the definition of agriculture. What's agriculture and what isn't. So those are things I think that we need to grapple with and wrestle with. You know, and the other thing is do we look at major changes to this, or do we try to tweak it somehow? You know, what do we do in a short time frame that we have to work with? And quite frankly, one of the other issues is the Senate. You know, well, where does the Senate want to go with this, and what is there going to be their thoughts? So those are kind of what we've been crystallizing around as we've been kind of reading through this, getting the legislative auditor's report and letting it soak. Those are kind of where we're at with grappling it, and I think we'll start, Representative Cronin and I are going to obviously visiting with some other people, but trying to come up with some thoughts and ideas about maybe a direction we could go, and obviously I think our charge from you, Mr. Chair, is to come up with some thoughts and recommendations. So that's kind of where we're at.
Thank you, Representative Demmer, and we'll have a spot open for next Friday for a hearing on that Green Acres bill of yours.
Well, we will.
We're ready to put that together. We'll,
yes, sir.
thank you so much for your work on that, because it is an issue this committee is going to need to work on this year. Representative Lanning, did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Howard, a couple questions. In your analysis, have you taken a look at whether or not there's any difference when a parcel is within the city limits and or completely surrounded by development versus a parcel that is still in unincorporated territory or not surrounded on all sides by development? Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, in terms of the Green Acres program,
yes.
Not the Farmland Preservation Program,
right.
Both qualify. So as long as the other criteria are met for eligibility, whether the land is butting up against development or whether it's out in a very rural part of the state really doesn't matter. Both types can qualify for the program, and both types are in the program.
Representative Lanning?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask that is it seems to me there is a difference between a property that is completely surrounded by development and within the city in terms of access to Green Acres for an indefinite, unlimited period of time. I can certainly understand it for a phased-in period of time, but for this to go on and on forever, what that does is it keeps an area from developing, adding to the tax base when it's, you know, within city limits, within incorporated territory, and it also places a greater burden on the other properties surrounding that Green Acres parcel in terms of having to cover the special assessments, the access, etc. So I guess I'm wondering if there isn't a sort of another layer or filter here that we need to look at in terms of our Green Acres policy. If you've got Another distinction it seems to me too, if you've got the owner living on the property, I think that makes a difference as well, as opposed to an absentee owner who doesn't live on the property. And so I guess I'm wondering about, in your analysis, whether those kinds of factors ought to be evaluated here as to what really should be our policy.
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, in fact, that is, I think, key to our primary recommendation is that there really are some important policy decisions to be made about who and what types of land should be eligible for the program, because right now all the scenarios you described are eligible. And as you've also articulated, that means that the surrounding property owners who are not enrolled in the program are paying a little bit more in property taxes than they otherwise would because of the tax deduction for those that are enrolled. Now, I do want to point out that you mentioned absentee landowners. A lot of agricultural land in the state is rented out to others that farm it, that till it. That's not an unusual practice at all. But they do qualify for the program, just like somebody who homesteads the land.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Just as a final thought, I would like to visit with our two colleagues who are working on this, because I think I've seen some instances where there are some problems with our current policy and statute.
Thank you. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three questions. First one, on the farm preservation, you mentioned that it couldn't have, like, utilities such as sewer or something like that. Is there a thought as to whether that's desirable? In other words, if you have somebody living there on that, is it possible it's desirable to have hook up to that, and even more so maybe with the types of farming operations we're seeing now, where they have big pits with the what would be, you might call, the sewer from the animals. Wouldn't it be desirable, if there was such a thing, to get that off someplace into a sewer system and treat it? Number one. The second question is, have we completely closed all the loopholes that used to exist, such as I had clients buying land and then creating a golf course to get Green Acres treatment until they could sell it for housing or for whatever type of development eventually got there. And the third is, did you look at the other, I think it's called the open space law or something like that, that's similar to Green Acres, the one that has the and how that works, like that building downtown Minneapolis that gets treatment like Green Acres for part of the building. So I'm just wondering those three.
Mr. Chair and Representative, first question had to do with the sewer and water hookup. I should point out that with the Greater Minnesota program, if the landowner desires those hookups, he or she could pay for them, and they could be allowed within a preserve. Now, that same a distinction is not available in the metropolitan area, but the law specifies that is a possibility for Greater Minnesota. Now, you know, I don't know, we don't have data on how many have chosen to have that kind of a hookup and agreed to pay for the special assessment, but it is at least an option for the Greater Minnesota program only. And then you asked about whether there are still loopholes, like allowing a golf course to have Green Acres treatment. The assessors that we spoke with are, I think, very diligent about making sure that the land is in agricultural production. We didn't learn about any golf courses that were receiving Green Acres treatment. Now, we did hear about, in terms of the farmland preservation programs, some rare instances, but some instances where land had been developed even though it wasn't an agricultural preserve. And this is one of the non-compliance examples that I mentioned briefly in my remarks. It had been developed. The 8 years that had been acquired to be used as agricultural had not yet expired, and the only reason it was detected is that some county officials, you know, who drove by saw it, and they took it off the tax rolls and, you know, refused to give it any more of the tax advantage. But the owner of the land and the township involved had not complied with the statutory requirements which would have otherwise kept it out of the golf course use for a full 8 years. And then finally, you asked about the open space law. We did not include that when we conducted our evaluation. We were looking specifically at these farmland preservation programs and the Green Acres Law and did not look at that open space law that you mentioned.
So, Ms. Baker, did you have a little something you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I was just going to add that the golf courses are specifically under the open space provisions. And the open space is similar to Green Acres, except its main distinction is a 7-year payback. So it is very similar in how it's valued and the differential and how they keep track of the difference in the tax or in the value and then in the taxes, but it's a 7-year. It's very similar, and I think the two get confused.
Representative
Mr. Chair, so Ms. Baker, then so that could still be going on under that statute quite a bit.
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, if you had a golf course that was, most golf courses are public. There really aren't too many private golf courses anymore just because the taxes have gotten so high. But you could have property that is a golf course that is being protected under this as open space. And it'll have a 7-year payback at the point of which when land is sold in it. So that could be going on. And I don't know if, I see there's a couple assessors here, and like Tom May might be able to respond, like in Hennepin County, if he has any cases like in Hennepin that you're referring to.
Representative Chairman, I don't want to bog it down, but I think we should. I mean, it seems kind of funny if you one person buys land to hold for eventual development and has to pay regular taxes, the other person sticks something on and gets tax treatment different. So it's something to look at.
We'll put her in the mix. Thank you. Ms. Howard, thank you very much for your thorough and informative report. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, if we could hear from the Department of Revenue. I know they're working diligently on this also. We have Mr. Gordon Spokesman here and Commissioner Ward Ines. And Commissioner Ines, Mr. Volkman, welcome to a new session.
Welcome, Chairman. Welcome.
Good to have you here.
Good to be back. Good to be back.
Thank you.
My name is Ward Ines. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. And first and foremost, I want to commend the Legislative Auditor for their very comprehensive, insightful, and maybe most importantly, timely Legislative Audit Report. We hope this serves as a catalyst for the legislators to take a review of this program. As you all know, the program has been in effect about 40 years. And the main features of the program really haven't changed in that time. So I think in that 40-year time span, the environment has changed, what is ag has changed, a lot of things have changed, but the program has remained fairly static. So I think this would be the appropriate time, this session, to really take a look at it. So the department's been engaged in this Green Acres discussion for about 2 years, 2.5 years now, Mr. Folkman and his team. If you recollect, the legislature directed the Department of Revenue to do an evaluation report of the Green Acres back in 2005. And that report was presented to the legislature in 2006. Many of the findings in the Legislative Audit Report echo the findings from the department's head. And so in that time frame, Gordon Folkman and his team has put together a bulletin to try to gain greater uniformity among the counties who use the Green Acres program. But there's really only so much we can do until I think the legislature looks at the program, tries to address some of the ambiguity in the program and the definitions. And so I really hope this is a great opportunity for the legislature really to take a long overdue look at the Green Acres program, make sure it's doing what it was intended to do, make sure it's still achieving, you know, appropriate public purpose, the tax benefits that's being given to the property owners. And I thought it'd be great if Mr. Folkman just go into maybe a little more detail. He's been up to his eyeballs in the Green Acres discussion for the last 2 years. He's pulled together a working team of assessors and department folks to put together that bulletin. So he's much more well-versed on the issue than I am, so I'd like to turn it over to him.
Mr. Volkman. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And what I'd like to do is maybe just bring the committee up to date in terms of some of the things that are going on to address some of the issues that the Legislative Auditor's Office raised, which I think was a very good report, really sets the context for the issues that need to be addressed. And I was also happy to hear Representative Zimmer, Representative Lanning, and Representative Mulway raising these policy questions, because I think it is time, as Commissioner Ines said, that the legislature take a renewed look at some of these policies, because one of the things that's very difficult to do in terms of trying to administer property tax laws and our responsibility as a department is to try and achieve as much uniformity and compliance with those laws as possible throughout the state. And when the state has such a varied set of economic conditions and situations out there, it's very difficult to get that uniformity in place. And it's better, to the extent we have clearer direction and policy intent of those laws, it A, adds greatly to our ability to formulate guidelines and procedures to send out to the counties, and correspondingly for the county assessors to implement in a more fair and uniform way. So the emphasis on looking at the policy intent, I think, is very important. And the key one with respect to the ag definition and the Green Acre program is what Jody Howard mentioned in terms of trying to come to grips with, you know, what properties and what uses should really be eligible for, I think, both the ag classification as well as the Green Acres program. And as everybody's indicated, the program has been in place since 1967. It's a long time. The situation throughout the state has changed significantly. It's time to revisit that. And to the extent we get some clearer directions, it's going to help us develop the appropriate set of guidelines that we can administer in a more fair way. Just to bring you up to date on some of the things that are going on, as Commissioner Ryan has indicated, we had a report that was mandated in 2006, and we followed up with that report with a bulletin we issued in October 2007. That bulletin was put together by, basically, we worked over the last summer. We pulled together county assessors and formed a Green Acres Working Group. We included legislative staff from both the House and the Senate in that Green Acres Working Group as well. And our primary mission was trying to come to grips with some clearer direction, some policy direction, with respect to what we interpret current law to be. And we felt that it was important to get some clarity on what policy changes or recommendations we could get to the assessors to administer the current law in a more uniform way. In putting that report together, we also purposely said that we would have the effective date for assessment year 2009. That's 1 year out from now. The reason we did that was twofold. One is we wanted to be able to, once we had the bulletin together, or put together, be able to distribute it amongst the county assessors for a wider reaction to the directives and the direction that we were given in that bulletin. And we held multiple meetings. In fact, we had about four or five regional meetings last month throughout the state with the county assessors to get more feedback on our bulletin. We also wanted to have an opportunity to present that bulletin and some of the directions we were giving to the legislature. So now you have this legislative session also to reflect on some of the policy directions that we're giving within that bulletin, and also put it in context to the Legislative Auditor's Report to maybe help shape the policy intent discussions that I'm hearing legislators starting to have. So there's an opportunity to react to the bulletin and give us some time to put things in place so that we can go forward with something that everybody seems to be a little more comfortable with. What I handed out was a summary of the bulletin. It was the first, what I call it, it's called the introduction. There was another term I had was sexier than that, but I've lost maybe too many green aces in my eyes right now to think clearly. But what the introduction was basically doing was to highlight for the legislature and for the county assessors those six areas of concern. And I think they were also presented fairly comprehensively in the Legislative Auditor's Report, too. These are the issues I think need to have the most attention and some clarity provided to us, and hopefully we can pull that together this session. Just to run through them real quick, it was basically mentioned in one way or another by Jody Howard, but coming to grips with the right methodology for determining when certain properties should be eligible for Green Acres or not, addressing the issue of whether or not there could be split classes primarily between agricultural and residential use, Get into some ag questions. What parcels less than 10 acres should qualify for ag use? How do we define exclusively and intensively? What do those terms really mean? Another ag definition question is primarily devoted to agriculture. What does it mean to be primarily devoted to agriculture? What are some of the operative guidelines that we want to use on that? Green Acres income threshold. Jody mentioned that we hadn't changed them since the conception of the program and the complications of using income as a criteria. And of course, the last piece there is the payback provisions. Links back to whether or not this program should be viewed as a tax relief or to what extent it should also be viewed as a preservation type program. One of the things we have also done now in recently too is that we've brought in the ag community to the discussion. We heard that from Representative Zimmer making reference to the fact that the whole idea of agricultural industry is changing. And so part of this discussion needs to get a better, greater sensitivity as to what kinds of ag activities or whatever other types of agricultural activities would qualify or should be considered qualifying in today's agricultural market. In fact, we're having on February 25th a meeting with the ag department, and they're bringing in a number of interest groups such as the hog growers, the Christmas tree farm people, apple tree growers, beehive people. So we're trying to get a wide breadth of input in terms of what might constitute appropriate agricultural activity, also to engage that part of the discussion into this framework. I'm also meeting with Senator Scoy next Wednesday to flesh out a little bit more in terms of what how he perceives this process unfolding during this legislative session. As I as was mentioned earlier, we did meet with Representative Marquardt earlier in the year, or late last year, and Representative Zimmer and Representative Conan have been sort of flagged, and God bless them for participating on this committee, but to help represent the House and try and flush out some of the tough questions that we have before us. I need to find out from Senator Scoy how he might want to be engaged in that discussion too. And so I'm going to meet with him on Wednesday to get a better sense of where he wants to go from the Senate side in that process. But because of the nature of some of the questions that we need to address, it was our recommendation that we try and set up a sidebar working group with key legislative representation, working with staff, that we can get a bill together and hopefully get it to you next week, Representative Marquardt, but don't count on it. But we'll try and work with the legislature, both House and Senate, to the extent possible, and working with the assessors to try and bring to the committee some ideas, what statutory language that makes some sense. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I tried to bring you up to date as to where we're at.
Well, Mr. Volkman, thank you so much. Sounds like we have a team together, and you're bringing in all the stakeholders, which is very important. And division members, if you have specific questions on that, talk to Representative Demmer, Representative Conan, Mr. Hines, Ms. Baker are working on that. So, you know, it kind of can be the conduit into this larger group. So it will be a goal to try to put something together this year in the division and tax committee, and hopefully bring some clarity to this issue.
Mr. Chair, I know it can be a difficult chore to undertake some of the broader policy questions, especially when it might end up people coming in and out of the program under existing law and practices. I would like to be able to package for the committee a set of minimum recommendations that make some minor changes to the existing framework that at least add some conformity and uniformity to existing practices. As a fallback, because I would like to be able to at least come out of this session with something in hand. The bigger question or bigger policy question, if we can get to it, that'd be great, but I'd like to have at least two plans in play if that sounds okay to you.
Mr. Volkman, so it sounds like you're pursuing in that direction, at least to have a fallback.
I hope
there it is. Okay, so at least that's step one. Very good. Any questions? Chair Linchevsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Volkman. And maybe I should ask this to Karen Baker, but you're here now, so I'll give it to you. Just stepping back from all the complications in these programs, and there are many, and I agree with you, there are so many policy initiatives involved that set the mechanics of these programs. You know, one is tempted to just say, let's just drop them all and let the market work, and that would enrage lots of people. So I understand the complication, but if you can step back from all this in Minnesota, in all your work, can you give this committee a sense of what's going on in the rest of the country? Do most states have programs like this? Are people trying to do things to either provide tax benefits or preserve ag? And is it close to metros or far out? Or, you know, just kind of where are we as a state? Is this something unique and we're overcomplicating the tax system? Or is this typical? Where is Minnesota in the big picture?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sinski, there are other states to Minnesota? I haven't noticed lately. I'm not that familiar with all the different issues that are going on, other types of programs. I wouldn't be surprised, though, that other states have similar types of programs and policies to try and deal with the tax burdens on agricultural property. As you well know, there's a fundamental issue with ag, with people trying to farm. They have a large acreage of land, value-rich, income poor or highly volatile income, properties that are being subject to all sorts of different economic pressures. We're losing farmland. Without knowing specifics, I wouldn't think we're unusual with respect to trying to address these issues. I don't know if Karen Baker's got other things to add to that, but I have not looked at other states specifically to find out what the array of programs and policies are.
And members, in the Green Acres report under the legislative auditor on page 27, there's kind of a summary of various states, about eight or nine states in the area, and a brief summary of what is being done. So I don't know if Ms. Howard would have anything else to add to that question either.
Income tax credit.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the fact is that all 50 states have some kind of agricultural protection program in place. Now, the details differ dramatically from state to state, but they all have something in place. A lot of them have some kind of a preferential assessment for agricultural land. That's very common.
Okay.
But a program where you apply, like in the Green Acres program, is less common. In most states, the preferential assessment just exists for agricultural land, similar to the way we have a classification rate that's low for agricultural land.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else, Mr. Folkman, that you would care to add?
One parting comment in terms of some of the difficulties that are being presented to assessors in this current economic environment is what assessors tend to try and do best is come up with highest and best use. And even during cyclical economic environments that we live under in today's world, that's even difficult to do. And when assessors are asked to come up with special use values, such as an ag value, that's very challenging. And then coming up with an ag value on land that's not even used for agricultural purposes, which the Green Acres program now requires, is even more challenging to boot. So we have to try and come to grips with just the art and science of assessment and what kind of science we can really pull out of that to meet the tax issues that we're trying to address. So just keep that in back of your mind, too, in terms of looking at the appropriate methodology to address these issues and using some valuation determination as to when people qualify and when they don't.
Thank you so much. Good information, good discussion. Thank you. At this time, we've got some minutes to approve. We've got the March 28th, 2007 minutes from last year, and then we have six other sets of minutes from our public hearings on February 6th and February 7th. So Representative Dietrich, would you care? Representative Dietrich moves approval of those seven sets of minutes. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of approving those minutes say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Those minutes are approved. Next on the agenda is a little bit of a discussion on one of the major items that came out of the division last year, over and over again, and that was the property tax refund program, its use, how well was it publicized, and one of the major efforts of this division last year, although never officially enacted into law, was to really ramp up the amount of publicity that went out. And even though, like I said, it did not become law, the Department of Revenue really took this one by the horns and took the initiative and has done a number of wonderful things in promoting that. And so we'd like to hear from them. But also, I know Representative Anderson and Representative Wapler worked on this issue last year. And I don't know if Representative Anderson, if you had some comments or you wanted to wait till after the Department of Revenue, but I really appreciated your efforts last year in looking at this issue also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that, you know, I'm impressed. I've gone through the folder with the different things. It is much more visible that people have access to this refund. I think that's a good step towards helping people at least be aware of it, and hopefully they'll try and qualify for it too. So, and Karen Baker was very good at helping us wade through this project for both Diane and I. So I'm just impressed with what I see in the folder here today.
There you go. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And who would like, Commissioner or Mr. Manson?
Yeah, Mr. Manson.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And Chairman, I want to thank you and the committee, because really it was the work of this division that really kind of fleshed out this whole effort on our part to do more in the PTR. I mean, you guys talked about the supercharged PTR, going to an automatic PTR. And we started looking at the research and realized that about a third of the people who are eligible for the current PTR are not claiming it. And so we thought maybe before we even decide whether it's a good thing to expand, and we think it is, makes a lot of sense to try to get more market penetration as far as the PTR and do our best to publicize what we currently have, because it is a very robust and generous property tax refund. So in pursuit of that, and based on the discussions you guys had in this committee, we undertook a bunch of that different efforts to try to do a better job of promoting the property tax refund. I'm just going to touch on a couple of them, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Manson to go over a more exhaustive list of all things we're currently doing, things that are in the queue, and then also some other ideas that we're thinking about, and just kind of maybe get some feedback from you guys of whether there's some gaps in our marketing campaign, some things we should look at. But I'm just going to touch on a couple of things that I was involved in. And one of the things was our instruction manual that goes out. Now, every year that there is reference within the document about the PTR, but it's buried in the text, and it's not very prominently displayed. So we thought this year it made a lot of sense to flag it on the cover and just say, you know, maybe you're eligible. Why don't you find out? Turn to the back. Kind of gives the income thresholds and different things, and gives the website. So we did that. That was a change that had never been done before, as far as putting it on the cover or more prominently displaying the PTR. We also made it much more visible on our website. It's on our title page. Click on it and go right to both the renter's credit and the homeowner's property tax refund. And we also made it one of the central features of our state fair booth. We featured three things at state fair booth. In the past, I think we've done a much more comprehensive state fair booth. We have a little bit of everything. We thought this year, let's just focus on a couple of key issues. Of course, our traditional one is maximizing e-filing, so, you know, make it simple on your, easy on yourself, e-file, the PTR, and then the military tax credit. We really focused on those three things. I think inside the brochure we have here, there's actually a picture of our state fair booth. But what I found out working the booth myself is that the vast majority of people think the PTR targets a much lower population, mm-hmm. income population. Mm-hmm. I mean, we showed them, you know, we had a little fact sheet about what our average refund is every year, $500-$600 per participant, what the income thresholds were. They were very surprised. And that's the big gap in the information in the public, is that they think it's for people with incomes of $30,000 or less. They don't realize that it goes up to $90,000 household income. So we need to do a better job of really highlighting that fact. And at the state fair, it really came home to me. We're right in the education building, kind of ground zero of the education building. Took a lot of traffic, handed out a lot of information sheets on the PTR. And almost to a person, they were surprised at how high the income threshold was. So I think we're going to try to do some more on that front. But, you know, I think I'll say our department, Gordon Folkman's team, our communications department really embraced this. You guys spoke loud and clear about the importance of promoting the PTR we have. I get a sense that it doesn't happen this year. In the future, we're going to be expanding our PTR program. There was a lot that the administration and the department liked about your turbocharged PTR program. We think that is the optimum way to deliver property tax relief. And if we're going to go down that road, we need to make sure what we have currently is being maximized and optimized, and people are aware of it. Otherwise, what's the point? So we're going to continue our efforts. If you have any suggestions after Jack goes through the more exhaustive list, please, anything we can do to promote this. This is a lot of dollars that taxpayers are leaving on the table. I think we did the revenue estimates, Representative Lanning, about going to an automatic PTR, and I think the cost of that going to full compliance 100% was about $200 million. So about $200 million is being left on the table by property taxpayers right now. So we want to close that tax gap and see if we can get those dollars out to the appropriate folks. Thank you. Mr. Manson?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I'd just like to say good morning and welcome back to everyone. Nice to see all of you. The commissioner did cover a lot of the highlights, so I'll just direct you to the packet, kind of walk you through. I'll be working off this two-page handout called Property Tax Refund Publication Notification Efforts, and that does detail all of the different marketing efforts that we pursue along with other partners with us in this endeavor. But what we're trying to do is improve public awareness and trying to increase participation. And the audiences we target are homeowners that would be eligible for the regular refund, homeowners that would qualify for the special property tax refund, and then renters who would be eligible for the property tax refund. Some of the methods to homeowners, just provide basic information on eligibility requirements. Also, the increased maximum income limits, which are indexed every year, they've gone from last year about $91,000 now up to over $93,000. And then also that is after you deduct for dependents and senior citizens. So, and then also just to encourage homeowners, make sure you qualify, even if you didn't qualify in the year before. You might qualify for special targeting. Income limits might have changed. I know when I worked out at the booth, the couples that came around that maybe just retired where the income's gone down kind of open their eyes that, oh, it goes up that high to $91,000. So you really got to check it every year. As far as the renters, again, our message is there. Eligibility, make sure you check it out. Again, the maximum income limit there is over $50,000 after subtraction. So, and then going through some of the promotions, towards the top here at the beginning of the list are some of the new things that the commissioner highlighted. On the MPR 1 booklets, that is the property tax refund booklets, those are sent out to all self-prepared paper filers from the year before. Also, they go to the libraries, and then also as a mandate from the commissioner, these are all now available in our regional offices around the state in their lobby area. The next thing down is property tax refund messages are printed on now the front and back of the income tax booklets. That's this green one here. You can see highlighted this new box on the front, and then eligibility information and how to get more information is on the back of those income forms and instructions booklet. We also have in your handout, there is a picture, as the commissioner mentioned, this is highlighted now on our Department of Revenue webpage, right there. Homeowners, you might qualify for a refund, also mentions renters as well. So it's right prominent as soon as you enter our webpage. That's new. That's something we've kind of highlighted in the past based on the timing of what's relevant at that time, but that's highlighted in it currently. Let's see, the next thing is something else we are just, this is a brand new, it should be ready next week or maybe up today, but we were adding a queue, so when you call our phone lines and you're waiting for income tax assistance, instead of just hearing go to our website or whatever, we're interchanging property tax messages in there to make sure you check if you're eligible for a property tax refund or a renter's refund. So that's something new that we added to our phone system. Further down, Commissioner talked about the State Fair booth. Once again, there is a handout in here, kind of picture of our booth, and the banner is on the right. If you look at below number two there, did you claim your property tax refund? It talks about the average refund of $570,000. That'd be a good refund. $570. And then it talks about renters, too, the average refund of $540. So again, that was one of our emphasis this year is that along with the military service credit. And we did also in your packet, we had a little handout at the booth, a notepad, so you have a little notepad, and we did hand out over 2,000 of these out at our booth. Just talked about don't miss out on these programs, something they could take with them. We also had magnets out there as well, I believe. And then also this little flyer too. Two sides again, but another don't miss out, and information on the back and with the average refund and who to contact and where to get more information. So we also handed those out as well, and there was about 1,000 of those were handed out. At the state at the booth, we've had a booth for a number of years, and this year alone we talked to approximately 5,000 taxpayers. We try and keep track of our contacts, the people that are working out there, and answered approximately 3,400 questions. You know, this isn't truly, you know, right on, but exact science, but kind of gives you a rough estimate of, we get a lot of visitors, and I think it's well worth our time and effort to be out there. Next is some of our partners in this campaign, the ARP tax aid, and then also our volunteer individual tax assistance volunteers, our VITASites we call them. They inform filers about the about this program as well. Also, there's, let's just pass that around, but in your packet there's also this paper clipped onto this poster like that is going to be going around now. This is new for this year. It was called 2008 Claim It Campaign, and we worked on this with United Way along with ARP and Accountability Minnesota. The cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the IRS, the U of M, Federal Reserve Bank were all part of this. And it just, as you can see, if you go down here, it talks about, it's all about free tax preparation, but what you should bring with you, and on here is mentioned homeowner statements and your CRPs, and so this is part of the program to make sure they're aware that they should also file for a property tax refund. And then you can see on the last page of this little handout is all the distribution outlets. You can see it went all around the state of Minnesota giving them information. It wasn't volunteers at all these sites, but just got the information out there so they knew that this was available to them. New then, also with some discussion about this last year in the tax bills, was the property tax statement, and put something on there. If you look at this, Spruce County, this is kind of the model that we send out to the counties, and right by the dollar signs there, and it asks about refunds questions. So this is prominently displayed on the front of the property tax statement, and then if you flip it over at the very top is more information on the property tax refund program on the back of that. So that was new this year as well. Very last line on this two-pager is we also send property tax refund posters that we design, and those are mailed to the libraries. You may have seen them around. And on the back, we also sent this flyer here that I mentioned before to 16 counties, including 5 metro counties, and then they were also distributed at county state fairs, or county fairs as well. So. We're also working on a property tax refund booklet translated into Spanish, and that will be also made available on our website, but we're hoping that would be completed by the 1st of March, so we're getting close on that one. We've also done some newspapers, articles, reminders on the property tax refund program. Property tax refund information is also included when you use tax preparation software. On the back, other things, the counties also provide information on their websites along with the cities. Not all counties and cities, but some of them do. House Research has information on their website. Legislators, some of you include newsletters and articles along in your mailings, and we think that would be very helpful if, you know, a lot more legislators would do that. And we would be willing to help share these any of this information that maybe you could pass out if you'd like. Now there's other, as you go down on the bottom half of that second page, there's other potential options, but they're more costly. A direct mailing of postcards was discussed sometime last year, and that estimated cost of that is almost $900,000. Radio spots, you could do 30-second radio spots, but again, you're looking at $9,000. So a lot of our efforts were trying to do things that we thought would work, that weren't so costly, And I think we've, there's more we could do, obviously, but I think we've concentrated pretty much in-house on what we could do. And I think if you look down, I think our efforts going on phase two here would be to work more with the cities and counties on getting them information that they can get out, get on their website. And I think that's really kind of the focus, and maybe other interest groups like ARP and tax preparer groups and that kind of. So I think our focus now will probably go a little more external and see how we can keep partnering and getting more information out there. But, you know, this is a very worthwhile program, and I'm happy about being able to market it.
Oh, Mr. Manson, Commissioner, this is great. It really is, and I just really, on behalf of the division, want to thank the department for your initiative on this and pursuing this. I agree with what Commissioner Ines said, that if we are going to expand this program, let's at first step is make sure all those who can apply initially are in it. Then you can work from that base and proceed. And Carolyn Chesky has been a champion, as you mentioned, in members also putting stuff out. And I think you're right. The next step is looking at cities and counties. And I know Ms. Baker was showing us, was that Hennepin County?
Ramsey
County something, or which county?
Ramsey
County, where they sent some stuff out. And wonderful piece, and I just think what you have here in this, even this on this statement right here is everyone gets that too. And I just applaud your efforts and really appreciate that, Representative Lentesky.
Mr. Chair, I have to say the same thing. This is fantastic. I think this is great, and I want to thank, in addition to both of you and the whole department, Ms. Baker, who has helped me for years, and our staff in doing these little dealies. And for other members who don't, just all you have to do is have your media person dump your name and photo in there, and you're good to go. And I actually stick these in, every letter I do to a constituent, just as a second piece in there to promote the program. And I can't tell you this on a personal level, how many people will say to me, I had no idea I qualified for that. I got a check for $800. I got a check for $400. And so many Minnesotans are unaware that we have this excellent program. So we are going to see the cost go up if we're successful. And that would be great. In fact, as I recall, when we got the expenditure report at the end of last session, the parts of the budget that are climbing a little higher than originally anticipated, one of them is this program. And I think that's great. I mean, we'll have to find the money over time. But I really want to thank you and Representative Marquardt and this whole committee who worked so hard on it. I think in the House we feel sad that our tax building gets signed that had a further promotion of this program, but I think we all agree it's a great program, and first steps are to move forward in more of this. So I don't want to put a burden on Ms. Baker here, but Ms. Baker and Katie Sen helped me create this piece, and I'm sure they could just pass it on to any member who would like to do the same thing. But I think all of this stuff is great stuff, and I'm planning now to insert these, I think, instead. Mm-hmm. I think this is a great piece just to put in every letter.
We like our happy house on that.
Yeah, and I thank you. I think this is just great stuff. And the one question I would have is, how are we doing on the renters? I think that is so much harder to penetrate than the homeowners, and they deserve that refund just as much. I mean, what can people do to help the renters?
Chairman, Representative Lentesky, it's a great question. And we also don't have a very good read. I talked to Dr. Wilson yesterday, a very good read on what the participation rate is among the renters.
Mm-hmm.
That
okay.
Two-thirds number is really the homeowner number based on extrapolating from the incident study and some other information we have. And so, Dr. Wilson's best guess that the participation rate is even lower among the renters because that is a more difficult population to penetrate. So we need to ramp it up. And I appreciate all your comments on this, but it needs to be. We also need to make sure we realize this is a multi-year effort. We got to continue to beat the drum on this because 1 year of marketing effort isn't going to do it. You got to continue and continue. And so often we talk about tax gaps in this committee and your committee, Representative Lentesky, but we always talk about the gaps that where people should be paying more to the state of Minnesota. Bridging that gap, well, I think these gaps are every bit as important to bridge and make sure we address these kind of gaps where money should be going to the taxpayer. So if there's one part of the budget I want to see grow, it's the one that's, the PTR and the renter's credit. And we'll do everything we can to try to maximize participation. But the renter's credit is in our population. We've done more on promoting some VitaSites we probably get a disproportionate amount more renters that go to there. But it's targeted at lower income individuals, our VITA sites, and also new Minnesotans, immigrants. So we're hoping that maybe we'll pick up some of those renters there and get them on the renters credit. It's a multi-pronged effort, and the renters credit is probably the toughest one to get at, no question about it. People are more mobile, you know, they move around more, so it's a little more difficult to the direct mailing at them or you know, whatever it is. So, point well taken, though.
Mr. Manson, any concluding comments?
Mr. Chair, just the point you had raised prior to the meeting that I was going to touch on, it's regards to participation and the cost of the program. I do have some numbers on the property tax returns we're seeing for homeowners and renters, and it has grown considerably from fiscal year 2005 was $280,000, and now it's up to $365,000.
Wow.
And the renters have remained fairly steady, about $280,000 over those years. So.
Chairman, can I make one more point?
Commissioner.
It's about our Spruce County property tax statement. Now, this is something our property tax division came up with, and 50-some counties have embraced a format very similar to this. But if you guys maybe check with your respective counties and just encourage them, if they haven't, to go down this route, because I think having it prominently displayed on the front and with the information, the relevant information on the back is very good. I think we've got about 50 to 55 counties who said they're going to go with this format, but there's a few outliers, so we'll keep working on them, and we think eventually we'll get most of the counties on board.
You know, Spruce County, it looks like the county levy's a little high. We're going to have to check into that. So, thank you so much for all of your efforts. So, appreciate that. So, we would like to, we may go a little bit over, but at least get some time here today on the study on the 4D. And we have Mr. Austin, or who? Mr. Austin, Mr. Volkman. Mr. Austin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, city members. My name is Larry Austin. I'm with the Property Tax Division of Revenue. I'm one of the regional reps. I work with the 7-county metro area and the city of Minneapolis. What I'd like to do, if I can, is give you a very brief overview of the 4D report, go through the recommendations. And if it's all right, before I do that, I would just like to acknowledge the people who were involved in putting the report together. We had a working group with three assessors, Dwayne Ebbinghausen with Beltrami County, Tom May with Hennepin County, and Al Whitcomb with Dakota County. Revenue representatives included Gordon Folkman, John Hagan, Dorothy McClung, and Lance Tarika, who is an attorney with the Appeals and Legal Services Division of Revenue. Our key stakeholders included Karen Baker with House Research, Jack Paulson with Senate Research, Tanya Orr with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Cindy Jepson and Julian Lascalzo with the Minnesota Housing Partnership, Caroline Horton with the Central Community Housing Trust, Paul Mazzacano with the City of Minneapolis, and Marge Aldean with the Minnesota Coalition of Affordable Rural Housing. The primary legislative charge for this report was to focus on the valuation of low-income rent-restricted properties and come up with some recommendations for best assessment practices. With that in mind, we did take four questions that we worked our way through. The first question we looked at was, how should 4D properties be valued for property tax purposes? Second question was, are assessors consistently applying valuation techniques statewide? The third question was, is the current classification adequate? And the fourth question is the current tax structure appropriate for 4D properties? In Minnesota, assessors are required to value all property based on a fee simple basis to value, meaning assessors use typical appraisal techniques to arrive at an estimate of value for each taxable property based on its highest and best use. Included in the methodology for income-producing properties is the use of market rents, market expenses, and market-derived capitalization rates. The working group and our stakeholders did agree to disagree on our first recommendation. The stakeholders felt that it was most appropriate to value low-income rent-restricted properties using restricted rents. The information that we collected from surrounding states and from the IAAO, which is the International Assessors Organization, indicated that from a best assessment practices standpoint, using market data was most appropriate. Our first recommendation is that the legislature should maintain the current statutory language, requiring assessors to use normal approaches to value using normal unrestricted rents when valuing 4D properties. The second question that we looked at is, are assessors consistently applying valuation techniques statewide? In our report on page, I believe it's 9 and 10, we did include some survey information related to assessor consistency. Overall, the working group found that the assessors have good, consistent valuation methodology and good communication. The second recommendation that we came up with is that basically, in order to maintain as much consistency as possible and to help all assessors improve their appraisal skills, the legislature should amend Minnesota Statute 273.11, Subdivision 13, to include 4D property in the list of properties requiring valuation by assessors who have completed the courses related to the valuation of income-producing properties. The Department of Revenue and the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers should develop and conduct frequent classes on valuation of income-producing properties, and more specifically, valuation of multi-tenant housing properties in order to promote greater consistency in assessment practices throughout the state. The third question that we looked at was, is the current classification adequate? As part of our discussions with out-state stakeholders, specifically Marge Aldean representing the Minnesota Coalition of Affordable Rural Housing, it was determined that none of the rural housing units financed through the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Housing Service currently qualify for the 4D class because of the current 75% threshold. The working group found that a change in the 75% threshold would benefit some rural low-income properties as well as low-income properties in more urban areas. The third recommendation of the working group is that the legislature should consider amending Minnesota Statute Section 273.128, especially Subdivision 1, containing the qualification for 4D properties by changing the 75% threshold to a lower threshold such as 20 or 25%. This would enable more properties to qualify for the 4D class, particularly those income properties in greater Minnesota financed by the Rural Housing Service. The fourth question that we looked at was, is the current tax structure appropriate for 4D properties? Over the past several years, class rates for low-income properties have been reduced in order to keep tax burdens affordable on these types of properties. Since 1995, the class rate has been reduced from 3.4% to 0.75%. The class rate at 0.75% is now 40% lower than the class rate on market rate apartments and 25% lower than the class rate on owner-occupied homestead properties. The fourth recommendation of the working group is that it supports the continued use of applying classification rates to the current market rate approach to value as the preferred approach to providing tax benefits to these types of properties. If the legislature concludes that the current tax results for Class 4D property are still not sufficient and need adjustment, the legislature should make adjustments to the class rate, not the valuation method. The final recommendation of the working group is that because rental housing can be, the market can be cyclical, the working group recommends that valuation trends and the tax impacts be evaluated over multiple years and not simply over 1 or 2 year periods. Specifically, the working group recommends that the Department of Revenue, in conjunction with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, should monitor and issue a biennial report providing information on the number of qualifying 4D housing units and current trends in market value and tax burdens on both market rate and 4D housing properties. That concludes my summary, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Austin. Representative Mulley?
Well, Mr. Chair, if they can do their presentation, then I've got questions.
Any further presentation?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I'd add is that what was handed out was the summary of the 4D report, and it is available on our webpage. Well, we can make the longer version of it available to the committee as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Mulley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was it Austin?
Yes.
No. I asked John Hagan last year why you treat this differently from a dedicated easement, and he thought and thought and came back a month later and said, I still can't figure out any reason. I'm going to try and figure out a reason. I don't understand a reason. They're identical in my mind as to how we should be treating them on assessment, and I don't understand why we should be using the overall best use when it is a definite locked in reduction in value. There's, I believe, other things than just the easements. In fact, I can't remember, but at the time I remember there were other things other than easements that restricted the use of the property, and therefore we don't use the full best use on it. And so the department has had about 10 months to think up a reason. Have they come up with something that can convince me that makes sense?
Mr. Austin?
I suppose you can't answer whether it makes sense to me, but the rest of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulley, Mr. Hagan, you give me a heads up on that one, so I guess I don't know what he came up with for an answer.
Mr. Chairman, that's maybe why Mr. Hagan's not here today.
He doesn't admit me.
No, I haven't figured out the answer.
I took a note.
I guess what I would like to point out is, as part of the process when we tried to determine what the best way to value these types of properties were, we basically looked at three things. How do states surrounding Minnesota value low-income rent-restricted properties? And what does the International Association of Assessing Officers recommend for best assessment practices for these types of properties? We also looked at some information that our key stakeholders provided to us, because there are some states out there that do mandate the use of restricted rents in the valuation process. When we looked at Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota, all of those states have the same mandate for valuation methodology as Minnesota. They require the use of market rents, market expenses, and a market-drive capitalization rate. So when we were looking at how best, from a best assessment practices standpoint, to value low-income rent-restricted property, we were kind of comfortable with the fact that three of our four neighbors agree with how Minnesota is currently doing it. When we looked at the Iowa approach, we found that Iowa mandates the use of restricted rents in Section 42 tax credit property, but when you get into Section 8 or other program properties, they mandate the use of market information. On new developments, new construction of low-income properties, they mandate the use of the cost approach only until it develops an income stream, and then they allow the use of the income approach. Interestingly, I thought in Iowa, apartment property is classified as commercial property. So we found enough issues with the Iowa approach that we felt that the Minnesota approach and the Wisconsin, North and South Dakota approaches were very conducive to the proper way to value these properties from a best practices standpoint.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly not an expert on Section 8 by any means, but aren't a lot of Section 8, at least the voucher system is, and I'm not sure how the other treat, but the voucher system is that basically it's up to the, they're not locked in. if I own property and I put a Section 8 person in there, I'm not locked in for years like I am on these government programs or even any of the type of things that we have in 4D. So I see a difference there, but I still don't, you didn't even attempt to explain why. I noticed that you avoided the whole question of why we treat those others differently, and I know Mr. Hagen has had at least since February of last year to think up an excuse for this, but as of the last time we talked, still hadn't figured out any reason. So maybe do we give you 10 months or...
We will bring that back to Mr. Hagen.
I'll take it. I'll hand deliver it personally, Mr. Chairman.
Any other further questions?
Just one other comment, yeah. If I could, Mr. Chairman. The other issue to keep in mind, the working group did look at the issue about providing preferential tax treatment, the need for affordable housing, and target it that way. And one of the things that the legislature has done is provided was through that classification rate. And keep in mind the classification rate going down to that 0.75% is based on a highest and best use valuation base. So the issue then becomes to the legislature to the extent that you now look at a more prescribed or income-restricted valuation approach, then if you require that, you might have to rethink in terms of what you want to do with that class rate preferential treatment as well. The issue would then be to what extent would you want to double a preferential valuation approach and a class rate. The class rate has been what we've been using up until now.
Mr. Austin, Mr. Wolfman, thank you so much for your report here. And what one final comment quickly.
No, just a quick question. If we use the class rate, and I don't understand all of it, but aren't some of the different programs limiting income in different ways and in different proportions to the highest and best use? And so wouldn't you, if you just use a class rate, wouldn't you create a disparity between properties that way?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert in this area either, but that's one of the issues about going to an income-restricted approach. You would have multiple impacts across the state in different areas. The highest and best use tries to set some standards, and the class rate then evenly applied to it. The impact certainly could be varied depending on the property and the income restrictions that are applied.
Thank you very much. Members, thanks for your patience. And going a little bit over, we're adjourned. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Chair.